Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. As usual, Alina is bouncing off the walls because it's ancient history today, and we all know that Alina is a not at all closet ancient historian. Alina, who have you got?
We've got Liz Gloyne with us, who is a senior lecturer in classics at Royal Holloway. She's also a blogger and a published author. Her most recent publication is Tracking Classical Monsters in Popular Culture. And today we're going to be talking about exactly that, classical monsters. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, lovely to be with you all.
Boom, both. Monsters. Who doesn't love monsters?
We all love a bit of monsters.
Very few people don't love monsters. I mean, this is kind of one of the awesome things about working on this topic is whenever I sort of say monsters, everyone's like, have you seen this one? What about this one? Oh, I love this one.
it's like the complete opposite of telling people you're an accountant, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, it was complete opposite of telling people sort of the other half of sort of my work is sort of focusing on ancient Latin authors and sort of philosophy and stuff like that. And I tell you, nothing shuts down a dinner party conversation faster than that does. Whereas monsters, everyone's got something to say because they are just everywhere. They're awesome.
Oh, so I don't know. Let's start then. How do you, when you're with your work, how do you define a monster?
It's a really interesting one because when we're dealing with certainly in the modern world, if you thought about monsters, who would you think about? People very easily jump to things like the serial killer, that kind of thing, sort of human monsters. I'm not focusing on those in my work, even though there are people in the ancient world who would very much fit into that kind of thing. If you go into myth, you can think about Medea, you can think about Clytemnestra, you can think about all these sort of characters who behave in sort of really problematic ways. What I'm interested in, though, is I'm interested in the monsters that you look at them and you go, oh, three slavering heads and two extra tails. That would be the monster. Excellent. Which classical myth is absolutely full of. We sort of still see turning up all over the place in popular culture today.
I was going to say, how many of them feature in Monsters, Inc.? How many have classical links? Sorry, complete tangent.
No, it's all right. There is one really interesting one in Monsters, Inc., actually. Is it Celia? The purple one with the hair?
Yes.
Yes, who is sort of a bit of a nod to Medusa, but not a full Medusa. It's quite interesting. Monsters, Inc. is kind of, veers away because he sort of doesn't. Because you've got her who's sort of got this Medusa nod going on. And then, the small green one with the one eye. What's his name? I've forgotten his name entirely. That's embarrassing. Anyway.
Oh, it's a Polish one. I should know this.
Oh my God.
Mike, that's the one.
Mike. Street cred just plummeted, yes. Didn't it?
Never mind.
Rostenkowski or something
that's
like
the one.
That.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Mike obviously sort of owes a lot to the Cyclops, who with only the one eye. So we're sort of riffing on that. But Monsters, Inc. monsters sort of really sort of reference the ancient monsters. They don't sort of replicate them entirely. They're sort of doing a really pastel coloured kind of monster.
Yeah. It sounds like there was just some early pilfering on the drawing board.
Happens all the time. Exactly. But this is it. They find their way in as this kind of influence, as this way we think about things, the way we conceptualise what a monster ought to look like, whatever then you put on top of it.
Sorry, total Alex tangent then. Sorry, Alina.
It's all right.
I was going to say, apart from Monsters, Inc., because we can find the monsters in Monsters, Inc., where else can we find these monsters?
Well, where do you want to start? You can find them in television episodes. You can find them in film. You can find them in video games. You can find them in advertising. You can find them in novels, in books. I mean, this is why I wrote a book about it, isn't it? Hmm. And even then, that's not sort of completely comprehensive because there's some stuff that I am not a video gamer. I'm many things. That is just not one of the things I am. But that is one of the really live places that lots of monsters turn up. Obviously, because you sort of need things to shoot. It's just the way they work. And the kinds of story. I mean, it's and there's also this kind of this interesting thing about what monsters are often used for, in that they are often used in narratives with heroes, right? If you think of Theseus, you've got to have a Minotaur for him to defeat, right? Perseus has got to behead Medusa, all of this kind of model about if you've got a hero, you've got to have a monster for them to defeat. So that's sort of one kind of story that often you find monsters in, the kind of hero narrative, hero quests, which obviously a lot of video games have that kind of quest narrative, you know, start at A, end at B, lots of dead digital bodies on the way. Mm. And you also find that in sort of a lot of contemporary film. Where they've sort, you know, in order to reach whatever resolution it is, something has to be killed off. Sometimes it's very interesting. It sort of doesn't really matter which hero it is. They don't mind too much. They're like, oh, you're a hero. Have a classical monster. But it's not my myth. Don't care. Have that one. Okay.
They kind of don't really follow what's supposed to be done. They're like, oh, look, that looks kind of cool. Let's do that.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And then at the same time, get really, really obsessive about being really picture-perfect detailed. And there's a great example of this in the film Wrath of the Titans, which is the follow-up to the reboot of Clash of the Titans, imaginatively named.
To be honest, I wasn't even, like, the plot, nothing. I was just looking at Sam Worthington.
There is merit in that approach.
Yeah.
Let me lose my track of thought there. Anyway, so
he,
you
he
kind
tends
of...
to do that to women.
And not just women.
Yeah, this is true.
It's the standing. It's the standing and looking broody. But you then, as I say, you have it right at the beginning, and because this is about to lead into a Sam Worthington looking broody and also being paternal moment, you have him sort of with his village that is being threatened, and the mother of his child has somehow died, and therefore we don't even get a conversation about this. He is clearly single parenting bravely. And then something horrible crawls out of a gulf somewhere and then comes and basically breathes fire at his village. You would have no idea this is meant to be a chimera unless you basically look at either the press release material around this film, or you go and look at, there's a little YouTube featurette about the making of the chimera. And bless them, they are so keen. They're like, we did this and we met, and this is how the fire ducts work. And, you know, and they've clearly sat down and gone, what is the biology of this monster? Mm. How do we make sure we've got all the feathers and things in exactly the right place? How does this all work? And then they don't even name it in the film. You're just like, what? How? How did that? How did you do that? What? Clearly, something in the editing has gone awry. And of course, the only purpose of this thing is to be interestingly dangerous, threaten Sam Worthington's small child, so that he is then able to go, ah, my small child is being threatened. Clearly, something is wrong with the universe. I shall stand by this window and brood. And then we get into an entire film about the issues. It is a film about, I mean, I actually think that Wrath of the Titans is better than the Clash reboot, simply because it is so much better connected by the entire daddy issues thread. It's much superior.
You mean there's actually a plot?
That helps.
Yeah.
It's not a film basically going, we're not the one from the 80s, which is what the previous one is about.
Well, so we asked you to pick three of these monsters and we're going to dig deeper. The first one you've picked is Medusa, because everybody loves a scary woman with snakes on her head. So tell us about her.
Oh, she is everywhere. The story that we get from her is really heavily influenced by the retelling that Ovid, the Roman poet who's about in the 1st century AD, gives in his big epic poem, The Metamorphoses, The Changes. And it's all about people changing from one thing into something else. And one of the changes he talks about is Medusa's metamorphoses. And he is very clear that what happens to her is she is raped in the temple of Athena by the god Poseidon. And Athena is so furious at this that she turns Medusa into the snake-headed scary monster. So we've got brilliant early victim blaming going on.
Yeah, slut shaming going on there.
Absolutely. Incidentally, this is one of the most frustrating things, because of course all of the translations of the Ovid, do they use the language that Ovid uses that makes it very clear this is sexual violence? No, they use words like seduced. And
These done by Victorians by any chance?
I wish. I wish.
Just people with a Victorian mentality.
Still being done in contemporary translations today. It's utterly infuriating. It's just refusing to sort of actually see that part of the myth because we can't possibly, right? It's ugh. So you've got this whole tendency of that. And of course, when you're thinking about the story like that, then it becomes about punishing women for daring to have sexuality, right? Mm. And then Medusa becomes the symbol of this sexually powerful, dangerous woman who then Perseus has to come and knock on the head. And it all becomes about monstering women being powerful and autonomous and in charge of their own sexual interest and that kind of stuff. As opposed to the story of rape survivor being brutalized again through no fault of her own, which is what you get when you start thinking about different variations. But one of the really cool things about the last, what, say 30, 40 years, is that the knowledge that there are two ways we could read this story has become more and more highlighted. So we're starting to get more and more stories which do explore that victim or that survivor side of things, and start retelling things from Medusa's point of view and start sort of thinking about alternative ways through that story, as well as the kind of ones which are Medusa is a powerful woman who needs to be shut up by a man. So you've got those two conversations now going on in receptions of Medusa in popular culture, which is really cool, actually.
I mean, I really feel sorry for her. Like, really, really sorry for her, because she's always portrayed in popular culture as in, like, this evil, psychopathic, I'm going to kill all the men kind of being, if that makes sense. Because they don't always quite stay loyal to it, do they?
Oh, gosh, not at all. I mean, the thing is, even in the original myths, I mean, Medusa is not, like, wandering around going, I'm going to turn everybody to stone! You know, she's sitting in a cave doing with her sisters, doing, like, nothing out the way. And Perseus turns up and goes, aha! So, you know, she's not rampaging. He actually has to go out of her way to find her. But of course, popular culture does occasionally put her in a more aggressive kind of role, if she's sort of incorporated into stories in that kind of way.
What's the worst incarnation you've seen of her? Which one just made you go, oh, no!
I think at this point I'm pretty inured to it, I'm afraid. I mean, oh, you know, it's just such a common trope. Yeah, I mean, there was a bar, somebody did send me a picture of a bar called Medusa somewhere in the UK. It was like, that's an interesting one. Hmm. You want your bar to turn people to stone? I'm not sure that's a good business model. I mean, this is kind of where the popular culture stuff gets quite interesting, because you get people who make references to this kind of stuff thinking they're being, I'm being very cool, I'm being very... It's like, have you thought it through? Really? Have you sort of considered the implications of using this image in your branding?
Probably not, sadly.
Well, exactly. Hire a classicist. Hire a classicist to do your consultancy. We're very happy to tell you why you might not want to name it that. But I think because this kind of thread of this very misogynistic use and understanding of Medusa just is so common at this point, as I say, I'm pretty used to it, really. It's just part of the tradition. And so while I don't necessarily shout at it anymore, I do get more excited by these more reclamatory positions either that come from a place of saying, all right, you're telling me a powerful woman, great, so Medusa is a powerful woman, we'll go with that, thank you. Or alternatively, ones which sort of explore that aspect of being a survivor of sexual violence to come to sort of a more powerful, more enriched exploration of that experience.
You did go with a male monster next. You went with the Minotaur, half man, half bull.
Absolutely.
Tell us about him.
He would be the second most popular, I think, who turns up second most. And I think his afterlife, actually, weirdly enough, has a lot to blame on, well, has a lot to thank, I should say, from psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic thinking. Because it's sort of become, the Minotaur has kind of become the symbol, as it were, for sort of a person's inner struggle, you know, you finding the monster within the maze and defeating it, except never really defeating it. But, you know, that idea that, you know, we've all got sort of a hidden animal inside us, you know, the hidden monstrous inside us. And the Minotaur's half man, half bull, half man, that sort of whole the way he can be used to think with about what it means to be human and what it means to be bestial. I think that sort of is why he sort of survives as well as he does and explains the kinds of things that popular culture does with him in exploring that idea.
He lives underground, doesn't he?
Well, he lives in the labyrinth in the
myth,
which is meant to be sort of, it's depicted as a kind of a building. But obviously, it is a building that has no windows. So, you know, it is dark. It is, it might as well be underground, really. Lots of receptions do situate it underground, do sort of give it that subterranean feel, precisely because of the idea of it being a very claustrophobic, very labyrinthine, very trapped kind of place to be in. Which, of course, is part of the point. There's sort of the claustrophobic aspect of sort of coming face to face with the bits of yourself you don't want to look at, right? That is absolutely central to the story.
I'm going to bring it up, and I know Alex is sitting there going, oh, God.
Oh, I know exactly where she's going.
I don't care. I'm going
to
go
on, go for it.
Oh, go for it.
Okay, so American Horror Story, because it is one of the best TV series out there, however disgusting it can be. So he actually comes up in the third season, and it's so basically what they do is they kind of put this bull head on a slave, and then he kind of like morphs into this like unkillable, immortal character through the whole series. And I actually feel kind of sorry for him. Like really badly sorry for him, because he's stuck in an attic, he's tortured, and then he kind of just goes on this rampage killing people. There's just like, for me, there's no classical background to it. It's like, we've taken a slave, we've put a bull head on him, there we go, he's now Minotaur. Go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not unlike a lot of what sort of things engaging with this kind of stuff do. They take a theme and they run with it. But I do think that idea, you can already see in sort of that summary you've given, the way in which it's sort of saying, well, you know, we're combining the human and the animal, which is going to be more powerful, right? The fact that there's a rampage that, you know, needs to be controlled, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's all very much in line with this exploration of what is and isn't human. So while it's not classical in like the strict sense, it's not following strictly what the classical myth says, it's picking up on those bigger themes and what the Minotaurs come to mean outside strictly the mythic tradition.
What's your favourite representation of the Minotaur?
I think the Minotaur takes a cigarette break is fantastic, because it's a really interesting exploration in a novel about what it might mean to be this mythical creature who's lived all the way through in a world where people are like kind of sort of aware you're a monster and sort of not. And this sort of how you engage in the modern world with a brain that's been around for however many centuries. And it's like, he gets confused by sliding electric doors.
I love it.
And it's like, it's technology. And it's a really slow and powerful and really powerful, reflective, you know, what would it actually mean to still actually be a Minotaur, the Minotaur, if you'd sort of crept out the back of the labyrinth and sort of made a deal with Theseus to get out of it, and you know, how would that all work? And it really makes you think a lot about what that means and how that transfers in some interesting ways.
That sounds brilliant. Your last choice, you chose the Sirens. So they appear in the Odyssey, and they're all over Greek mythology.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about these winged singing women.
Well, the thing about the Sirens in the Odyssey is Homer doesn't tell us what they look like. Everyone assumes he does, but when they go back and check, they're like, oh no, he doesn't. He tells us what they sound like, he tells us where they live, he tells us what they sing, and he doesn't give us a single description other than indicating that they're female.
That's helpful.
Well, you know, it's a start. So you actually have this really interesting thing where, well, clearly we've got early artistic representations for archaic Greek art, where you've got birds with women's heads who are meant to be the sirens. And they then slowly over time morph. We can blame this directly on medieval bestiaries. Incidentally, you can actually track the difference in what they look like in myth bestiaries, categories of myth, where people are sort of listing what animals there are and that kind of thing. And you can see that some of them carry on with this bird-headed woman thing. And then you end up with this visual tradition of women with tails like fish instead, which of course takes sirens into mermaids.
So that's medieval when
that starts sort of turning up in about medieval period, absolutely, as a visual change.
That happens in Poland as well, actually, because I've been daring to say this. This whole thing, I was like, yes, we have one of these in Poland in the 14th century, stories to do with Warsaw, which, because I've just been listening to you say that, I was like, yes, because we have exactly one of those.
So you sort of get this, as I say, you get this sort of shift that happens in the medieval period from what sirens look like. And then obviously you get sirens being sort of mermaids singing from the sea. It's one of the reasons sirens are kind of slip out of sight a bit, because they get subsumed into the mermaid type. And people sort of are only doing sirens if they're thinking very deliberately of myth. But they're kind of getting a comeback as winged birds. That, again, this kind of desire to be authentic TM, to do monsters properly in popular culture. Show I was paying attention during my Myth 101 course, or that I've read the Wikipedia page or whatever it is, right? You're starting to get monsters being represented sort of a bit more, as the sources say, and that means we're starting to see some more winged sirens coming back, which is quite cool, really, to see the shift coming and changing because of the way that the information about them is now being more available and people are making different artistic choices.
I mean, if you're wrapping the mermaid thing into it, then they really are everywhere in film, aren't they?
And I'm
just thinking of their little bitches in Harry Potter, aren't they?
Oh, completely.
Necessarily, like, because is it that the mermaid are more sinister, but then there's sort of this whole romanticized thing, like Hans Christian Andersen, and now we're getting, again, like you say, the more accurate description of them perhaps being a little bit cheeky and badly behaved.
Well, being a bit grittier, no, absolutely. And that kind of willing, I mean, certainly the very romantic, the very, oh, beautiful women, I shall fall in love with them thing. I mean, it's demonsterizing, isn't it? And also it's sort of flattening in a sense, because it's all about, and you get the stories, I mean, the Little Mermaid, obviously, and you know, wanting to have proper legs, and, you know, the desire to be fitting in order to be loved by a man, because that's obviously what we all want in our lives, is to be loved by a man who will marry us and therefore complete our destiny on our marriage day, and never mind the next 50 years.
Yeah.
Sorry, not that I have.
No, but it's true, isn't it? It's like, that's like the end of her story now, and what she's supposed to be in that, 16?
Exactly.
But then, I'm not going to lie, that was my childhood. Every morning before school, I would run up and down the front room watching the video, pretending to be the Little Mermaid, so I'm a hypocrite.
No, you're not. You're just enculturated, isn't it? I mean, the point is that spotting these stories and seeing the way that these things become presented as if this is what you're aiming for is part of why it's worth looking at this stuff. It's part of why it's worth doing the media study stuff, and why it's worth saying, so what cultural work are classical monsters doing now? What are they presenting as a norm, as something that should be done? And they are used, really, to do this kind of policing work around gender, around race, around sexuality, by sort of saying, well, this is... The people who these characteristics belong to are the other, are monstrous. And as I said right at the beginning, when you've got a monster, you need a hero to come and knock them down. And therefore sort of say, well, that's not what we should be doing. You know, if you behave like this monster does, wallop. And that's sort of a trend in how monsters work and how they're thought with in all kinds of culture. So stopping and having a look at how this kind of cultural mechanics of making sure everybody does what you're supposed to do according to a particular dominant group is actually really important.
What is, out of all of this, your favourite TV programme or film? Because there's got to be at least one that shows something as close as you could go, probably, to the classical story.
Well, I think my favourite debrief programme out of the lot of it, in a very odd sort of way, is probably Hercules the Legendary Journeys, just because there's a huge corpus of stuff about it. And it's very playful, it's very daft. It's not at all historically accurate or mythically accurate, because if you were going to do the story accurately, it would all go to Kingdom Come very quickly, and you would have a very short series that wouldn't be able to be family friendly and shown before the watershed. But I think what I like best about versions of myths are ones where they're not too serious, where they're not too, don't take themselves too seriously, because then you get stuck in this really fixed kind of, we have a narrative. I mean, another really great one is O Brother, Where Art Thou? By the Coen brothers, which is based on the Odyssey, where they are so playful and so clever. Their sirens are women who are washing clothes at a stream and sort of get the singing this song, who sort of lure the three male protagonists in with sort of moonshine in the age of prohibition, and they sort of wake up in the morning going, one of them has been turned into a horny toad. No, not that horny toad has like any kind of subtext in this kind of context. Turns out that what they've actually done is they've sort of taken this guy and handed him, who's been wanted by the police, and handed him to the police, and there's sort of a reuniting scene that happens in a dark theatre that's sort of very Descent to the Underworld-y. But for a short while, we're actually in a film which invites us to believe that he's really been turned into a toad by these witchy women, and is sort of willing to entertain that possibility and live in that space. And I think films that try and engage with this stuff with an element of flexibility produce the best results, to be honest, rather than getting absolutely fixed into a this is how we have to do it mode.
I have to say that Alina and I, being the age that we are, absolutely adore the Disney Hercules.
So much fun.
Love it.
We do. We're actually going to do a podcast about it, because they're bringing out the new film, aren't they, at some point soon, which I'm really disappointed in. Why turn a Disney film into like a feature film with action?
Oh, is this a live action number?
Money.
I've missed this completely.
They're working through their entire back catalogue and spinning it for money, aren't they? Some are good, some are awful.
No, none of them are good. None of them are good. The Disney version is the only version with the awesome singing, that you can't recreate that as a live action. It just doesn't work.
Because one of the wonderful things about that is the way that it uses sort of the imagery of Greek pots in sort of cartoon form to do the kind of do the chorus kind of stuff around the music stuff. I mean, how do you live action that?
And that was what was so special about it.
The visual aesthetics of that film are absolutely stunning. Mm. And it's still quite scummy. I rewatched it for the book, and Hercules' fight with the Hydra in that is actually still really scary. It stands up as still extremely well-paced. And again, how do you do a Hydra? I think what I love about that film is that it crosses into this cartoonish world of allowing us to believe that it's real. In a way that you can kind of buy into the real danger posed by the mythical monsters that Hercules faces. And if you're doing it in CGI, there's just something that falls over.
Do you know what? That there is never, this isn't monsters mythology, but there is no better example of that than that horrible Noah film where you sit and you watch it and you go, this plot is shit. And then you go, oh, it's the Bible. The Russell Crowe one, where you're like, oh.
Which I've missed, I'm trying to say.
You watch it and you're like, this is so unbelievable and ridiculous. I'm not buying into this plot at all. And then you go, oh man, they got this from the Bible. This is deep. I have to question my whole like understanding of existence now.
Well, go and say a better adaptation, which is the other alternative. No, but I think sort of there is this thing about CGI as a real, I think CGI is really deadening in some really interesting ways. Mad Max Fury Road deliberately did not use CGI for any of the really cool bits. All of the road chases are real. All of the people you see are real in costume. I think they only used CGI for bulking out big crowd scenes and for sort of doing weather effects. and landscape effects and that kind of stuff are the big things. Everything you see being done in the cars in Fury Road is stunt driving, is live.
There's a point to that, because we've had numerous programmes on here where we've talked to Johan Griffith and Jamie Bamber about Hornblower, and we've had like loads of Sharp cast on, and these fell into that bracket right before CGI really took off and became a thing. So like when they were filming Sharp, the battle scenes, they're not computerized, and literally all the extras would die once and I think run off around the back and come back and die again.
It's the way to do it. It's classic.
But, yeah,
classic stuff.
You're right in that it does I think the deadening argument. I do think they'd be very different television programs. I know they're not mythological, but if they had CGI and they could just go, oh yeah, we'll just sink the boat like a computer boat.
I think there is something really for monsters in particular. I think something about having them represented by computer generated graphics really does just take away from the power that they have. I mean, which cartoon doesn't? Because you're already kind of suspending belief when you're in cartoon, right? You sort of expect things to be a bit,
yeah,
wacky.
I mean, it's like Jurassic Park. They built those dinosaurs.
Exactly.
They weren't screaming at I think was it an extent of it, but they weren't screaming at a stick with a tennis ball on the end. There was actually a whopping great big
something thing. There. Exactly. Yeah. So I think there is something really important, certainly for monsters, about not getting over in love with the tech, because I mean, to go back to the Chimera, that desire to make this big thing absolutely perfect in every scale and every claw just totally got in the way of it actually doing what it needed to do in terms of a monster. You know, it had its slot and it was like, yes, look, we read our myth 101, and then so what?
Yeah, it's gone.
Worthington's killed it. On to the next thing for Worthington to kill.
Yeah.
You know, it just stops it having any kind of narrative power, which weirdly enough doesn't seem to happen in the Disney Hercules. I mean, you wouldn't have thought you'd be here holding Disney Hercules up as a fantastic example of how to do monsters right, but here we are.
Mm. Are there any others that you really hold up, like alongside Disney's Hercules, as the way to do it right?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I think A Brother Where Art Thou is a great one, and I think sort of Pan's Labyrinth, film directed by Guillermo del Toro, is also really interesting for sort of being quite reflective and intellectually engaged and thinking. I mean, I think, as I say, it's these pieces that think about what monsters can do rather than getting obsessed with the detail and getting the details right. That seems to be the distinction.
Liz, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about all these really awesome, cool monsters, because they are awesome and they are cool. And for talking to us about the Minotaur, talking to us about the Sirens, and of course, the lovely poor Medusa. Love to have you back on again. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you.
Join us tomorrow when Matt Breen will be with us. He hosts the Explorers podcast, and we asked him to pick his top five and talk us through why they make his list and why they were so epic. So don't miss that. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.